music as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson is the founder of the Seattle Poetics Lab and the Cascadia Poetry Festival. He is author of American Prophets, interviews with thinkers, activists, poets, and visionaries. How are you doing this morning, Paul?
Ethelbert, very well, thank you.
Well, you know, I want to thank you for being back on the show. You sent me a copy of American Prophets back in May. This book has 16 interviews, 8 are with poets. And I want to first talk to you, Paul, about just the interview process, okay?
Mm-hmm, sure.
How important are interviews in helping one understand a writer's work? Can the interview be trusted?
Well, is the narrator reliable? I mean, it's like fiction. Does this person know what they're doing? And are they asking questions that are interesting? Are they interviewing people who have something to offer, or are they just interviewing celebrities because they're famous?
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed you when you came out with a book of In Search of Color Everywhere, a collection of African-American poetry. And I didn't know jack about African-American poetry, but I trusted that you were a reliable narrator or curator or anthologist. And I read it with earnest. I tried to ask intelligent questions and tried to give you space to say what you needed to say. And I think that's been my style from the beginning. I was doing interviews at the beginning of my 26-year radio career, interviewing Wynton Marsalis in 1980 in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, people look at the book and they think, oh, it has an interesting cover, or there's some people in here that I've heard of, or this sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my own partner said calling this interviews doesn't do the content justice. Because you learn from this. I mean, I've had the opportunity to interview from the very beginning brilliant people. I mean, you know, you look at Nate Mackey, Allen Ginsberg, Jerome Rothenberg, Wanda Coleman, Sam Hamill, Brenda Hillman, some of the poets. These are brilliant poets. These are some of the best poets of the, you know, post-Vietnam War era in this country. And I'm just lucky as hell to have been in a position where I could interview them.
Well, how did you change as an interviewer? I mean, you talk about the learning process, and then I think in any craft, you know, you get better. Were there things when you started out that you said, well, you know, I asked the wrong question, or I didn't pace myself during the interview? How did you change?
Well, all those things. I didn't read the whole book, you know. And at the end of the interview, the guy says, I wish you would have read the whole book, you know. I mean, I had to learn that early on. It's like, mm-hmm. Do you at least read one book? There's an interviewer, a literary interviewer down in L.A. who reads everything that the person does. Well, you can't get that done in an hour. You know, mm-hmm. You've got an hour to deal with someone. That's another thing I learned. I did 2 hours with this guy who was a Nostradamus scholar. He's brilliant. He's done many, 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 many interviews. But by the end of the 2 hours, he's like, let's make this stop, please, because mm-hmm. It's an intense thing. The same with Wanda Coleman. You know, Wanda Coleman couldn't even do 2 hours, and you know how much energy she had.
Right.
So you learn as you go along. And you know, Ethelbert, I started doing interviews really full-time in 1990. Mm-hmm. So it's coming up on 30 years of doing interviews. And I think if you do anything for 30 years, you know, you're going to get better. It's like Bill Ransom. His writing theory is keep writing, it gets better.
Mm-hmm. What person was the most difficult person to interview?
I can't remember exactly, but there were a lot of politicians who I've interviewed. You know, I remember interviewing a guy running for U.S. Senate who later became the King County executive. And, you know, I have a 30-minute time slot with him, and his first question he answered with kind of platitudes and abstractions and generalizations. It went on for 8 minutes, and I said, look, if you answer every question with an 8-minute answer, I'm only going to ask you 3 questions,
right.
You know? And I started, at that moment, although I didn't know it at the time, I started to really understand the difference between rhetoric and poetry, because mm-hmm. I'm not interested in rhetoric, you know? I mean, it got to the point where my partner and I were Bernie Sanders supporters 4 years ago, and, you know, we go through to his Safeco Fields talk. We wind around the neighborhood. We finally get in. There's all kinds of, you know, guy playing the Star Spangled Banner on harmonica, and we start listening, and we look at each other, and we're like, are you into this? And she's like, no. And we agreed with the rhetoric. But, you know, when you train yourself with poetry, you want something transformational, right, and not rhetorical.
Well, you know, I looked at your book, and I want to ask you, what is the difference between the interview and the conversation? Because I was reading your interviews, and some of them, to me, were more conversational in tone.
Well, I like to think of all my interviews as conversational. I like to think of them as a conversation that someone happens to be eavesdropping on. And so I bring a lot of me to the act of the interview. You know, I was in radio for 26 years, and so that's an important part. I think the tone allows a person reading or a person listening to get into it, mm-hmm, to be able to have that, hey, this is an interesting dialogue that they're having.
Well, and you see, that's what I'm saying, right? Because if I could pick up the book, I see a dialogue. If I see, okay, here's a paragraph that, you know, to Ginsburg, here's a paragraph for Nelson. If I see that, if I just see you asking one, you know, this one sentence from you, and then the person's responding with a paragraph, when I look at that, that to me looks like an interview, not a conversation, and not a dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I think these are more dialogues, then, to put it in that perspective, mm-hmm, and I think that's always what I was after. Someone very early on in my interview career, I interviewed Tim Weisberg, who put out a record with twin sons of different mothers, and I forget the other person who was more famous. Anyways, you know, I was new at doing interviews. It was 1989 or something, and somebody said, man, I really enjoyed that. It was like a conversation between friends that I was eavesdropping in on.
Right.
And I took that as praise.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I attempted to do. And, you know, it's who I am anyway. You know, when I see someone, like I'm at a writer's conference last week, when I sit down with someone at the lunch table and start talking with them, my interview skills are at work. You know, where are you from? Mm-hmm. You ask a person from Chicago, where are you from? And they'll say Chicago, even though, you know, they lived in Portland for 40 years. You know? So it's a different thing. When you ask me where I'm from, I'll always say Chicago, but I live in the Rainier Beach neighborhood of Seattle, for instance.
Yeah, so, I always associate with the Northwest. I just give you a larger region.
Yeah, well, you could do Cascadia. I'm from that bioregion. Of course, I've done a lot of work on the bioregion of Cascadia, and that will probably be the next book of interviews, Cascadian Prophets.
Okay. Well, you know, last year, April 14th, to be exact, 2018, the poet Sam Hamill died. And I want to talk to you about him. You have an interview in the book that you did back in 2002. Talk about Hamill and his contribution as a writer and also a founder of Copper Canyon Publishing Company in 1972. But talk to him about in general, and then I'll ask you about, you know, the personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam Hamill was an abused orphan growing up. His father was an illiterate fry cook from a carnival. You know what I told the New York Times obituary writer about this? He's like, come on, who's going to buy that, you know? And I said, check with the other people, that's his story. And he was adopted by a Mormon family in Utah, and they abused him. And he left at a very young age, and he was a juvenile delinquent. He was stealing hot-wiring cars, and he got hooked on heroin, and he loved the Beats, and he was sitting outside City Lights, and Kenneth Rexroth saw him and said, come on, we got to get you off that. I'll make you a meal. And Rexroth saved his life. And, you know, his father, his biological father, was illiterate. So he went out and he learned more about languages, translated from different languages, started a press, has a great body of work as a poet, as an essayist. I think as an essayist, he's underrated because his essays are brilliant. And he really understands the practice of outside, or, you know, that kind of West Coast projective or organic style. And, you know, Copper Canyon Press has been going on 50 years now, and it's probably one of the top three poetry presses on the continent, and it started with him. There was a commitment to Zen. He really understood the Zen approach. He really understood that the West Coast looked more towards Asia than it did Europe, and he understood bioregionalism. He was interested in that from the very beginnings of that in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, he's going to be a force to be reckoned with because of his commitment and his understanding of emerging trends. The whole Zen thing as it unfolded starting on the West Coast in the 50s is, I think, has really influenced the culture.
Mm-hmm. And talk about his position in terms of being against various wars.
Well, you know, that was one of his big claims to fame, the one that got him a lot of notoriety, Poets Against the War. He was invited to the Bush administration to honor three poets, and I believe they were Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and Langston Hughes. Now, if those three were alive today, they might be pilloried, because I think two of them were homosexuals, and certainly one of them was a communist, you know. So, you know, Sam knew that it was BS, that it was going to be some kind of a BS thing, and he, of course, didn't approve of the policies of the Bush administration, so he said no, and he made his no very public, and he asked his vast network of poets to say no as well, and to respond to the warmongering foreign policy of the George W. Bush administration, and it turned out to be successful beyond his wildest dreams. There were 20,000 poems. It became an online anthology and a book, and I think it was the single largest single-issue poetry anthology in the history of time. And, you know, it had an effect. I mean, it had an effect on poetry. On the culture, I'm not so sure, because that war still hasn't ended.
That's right.
You know, I mean, 18 years or something like that of endless, it's really not a war, it's an endless violent occupation. But he was there, and I think more than anything else, to galvanize poets and to give them the voice, and to, you know, to say that poetry should mean something. It should be about something. I mean, if you look at some of the various poetry movements of the post-Vietnam War era, you know, what's the content? You know, if you have to ask the question, is content important, then Sam believed, you know, we've got a problem here. Mm-hmm. And so he was going to make it very clear what these poems were about. And it was a huge thing and brought him a lot of attention. And I also think jeopardized his standing at the press, because, you know, they, while he was out doing Poets Against the War thing, his standing at the press started to weaken, and he lost his job, partly, I think, as a result of his activities.
Mm-hmm. When did you, Paul Nelson, meet Sam Hamill?
In the early part of this millennium. I think it was right around 2002. I think that interview in the book was the first one I did with Sam, and it was at the Port Townsend Writers Conference, which I just attended last week in Port Townsend, Washington. And, you know, I first wrote him and said, I'm interested in writing an epic poem. At the time, I called it an epic, that reenacts the history of the town I live in, Auburn, Washington, which was originally founded as Slaughter, which you've interviewed me about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be based on Charles Olson's Maximus poems and William Carlos Williams' Patterson and Diane de Prima's Loba. And I emailed him just out of the blue because I wanted to do a residency at Centrum at Fort Wharton, where the Port Townsend Writers Conference is held annually and where Copper Canyon Press continues to be based. And he basically, and I can hear his response in his voice now, and he said, "Why do you want to write like De Prima? She's a windbag." <laughs> You know? And I was kind of taken aback by that. Your first communication with someone, and he's already being, you know, he's already putting this person down. And I disagree with him. I think that Diane de Prima is an amazing writer, and I've gotten a lot from her and from reading her work. But yeah, I interviewed him. He was hearing me on the radio at KPLU, the local jazz station at the time, playing jazz and reading poems, and then going into jazz related to those poems, like reading Quincy Troup's poems about Miles, and then playing a Miles Davis tune.
So you know what we're going to do here with Mike's help? We're going to play a poem, What the Water Knows by Sam Hamill.
Sure.
What the water knows, what the mouth sings, the soul must learn to forgive. A rat's as moral as a monk in the eyes of the real world. Still, the heart is a river pouring from itself, a river that cannot be crossed. It opens on a bay and turns back upon itself as the tide comes in. It carries the cry of the loon and the salt of the unutterably human. A distant eagle enters the mouth of a river. Salmon no longer run, and his wide wings glide upstream until he disappears into the nothing from which he came. Only the thought remains. Lacking the eagle's cunning or the wisdom of the sparrow, where shall I turn, drowning in sorrow? Who will know what the trees know, the spidery patience of young maple, or what the willows confess? Let me be water. The heart pours out in waves. Listen to what the water says. Wind, be a friend. There's nothing I couldn't forgive.
What the water knows. Paul, you know, when I listen to that, I wonder whether you would say that he also has an influence on your work.
Well, yeah, no question about it. I mean, Sam was a dear friend, a brother, and a teacher for a long, long time. And, you know, we had a lot of difficulties. Sam had a cruel streak. And many of us, all of us, anyone close to Sam experienced it. And, you know, when he would be cruel to me, I would just stay away for 3 or 4 months. And I would just, I can't say the word that I was thinking of in my mind because this is live radio. But you can imagine how I would respond to that. And then he'd send an email or something and say, hey, it's been a while. Let's have sushi or let's play golf or something like that. And so I'd come back to him. But, yeah, Sam is seminal in my life. There's no question about it.
Well, you know what I found interesting, which is on the back cover of your book, American Prophets. You are his executor of his literary status. I'm correct?
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Okay, what does that entail? And I want you to maybe respond in such a way that it's helpful to maybe any of our listeners who are in this situation where they have to take care of a writer's, you know, work in the state.
Well, I think the number one thing is that people will want to publish Sam's work. They'll want to put it in anthologies, and they'll want to do this and want to do that. And you have to suss out whether they're real or whether they're jokers. You know, you have to find out if they've had a background, if they're legitimate, or if this is just something where they just want to make money off Sam's name.
Would you be the person that would decide how much someone would have to pay to reprint something by Sam?
Okay. Yes.
And how would you determine that?
Standard. You know, this is the first time I've done it, so I would talk to other executors that I know. I would talk to Aaron. Aaron's his daughter, and you know, as you were playing What the Water Knows, I Googled it, and of course it came up through the poets.org website, and it says at the bottom, used with permission of Aaron Hamill, so they went right to her, which is fine with me. You know, Aaron, obviously his only kid, if it's okay with her, it's okay with me. So I work really in partnership with her.
What about unpublished material? You made reference in this show about, you know, him being overlooked as an essayist. Are there essays that are unpublished?
No, I think most of the there's one essay that he wrote about his exit from Copper Canyon that hasn't been published, and probably better that it not be published.
Now, whose decision is that? Is that your decision? You're laughing. You didn't answer the question. Is that your decision, Paul? Paul, answer the question.
It's interesting because
you're not answering the question, Paul.
I'm not. I don't see it getting published. I don't see if there's a call for it to be published. First of all, except by the guys from Dispatches from the Poetry Wars, Kent Johnson. He really wanted to publish it.
Who has the veto? Say, is that you?
In that particular case, I talked to Erin.
Okay.
And she said, no, now's not the right time to publish that particular piece.
So is that something that we know in terms of collections where something is just, say, okay, will be published 50 years later or whatever for various reasons? Is that how that would be handled?
That might be handled if it's after my time.
After my time.
That's right. I'm going to punt to that one. No, I mean, people can go to his Ohio State University archive and they could see it there. I mean, if they're really interested, you know, if Sam ever, if anyone ever wanted to write a biography about him, I would say you got to go to Ohio State, mm-hmm. and you got to see the archive there that he sold before he died and ended up spending on sushi and sake and golf.
what about correspondence? You know, but I think of someone who's, you know, operating like a press that's using many correspondence, you know, letters between writers.
Oh man, Sam's got all kinds of letters with some of the best people ever. I mean, you know, Robert Duncan wanted to publish his last book, you know, the one that took him 25 or 15 years. He went on a 15-year hiatus from publishing. Duncan did. Mm-hmm. And then Groundwork is the book that came out, and it eventually came out on New Directions. But he was talking to Sam about publishing it at Copper Canyon, and he just wanted Sam to scan the typewritten poems and put them in the book that way. And Sam said, that's not publishing. I can't do that. So he didn't publish Duncan, mm-hmm. which, you know, you look at it, maybe that was a mistake. I don't know. But yeah, there's letters with Duncan. There's letters, obviously, with Rexroth. I mean, I look at his tenure at the Port Townsend Writers Conference. Denise Levertov, Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen. It goes on and on, yeah. and on. And then he was also there for the Jazz Port Townsend, which has happened every year. And he got them to bring Dexter Gordon, and he had a friendship with Dexter Gordon going for a while. So it's not just literary figures, mm-hmm. but it's art figures. And Sam himself was a brilliant painter. I was given many of the paintings that he did, and he did these postcards, and it's incredibly beautiful painting, and nobody knows about that. Right. And he was a gifted painter.
Mm. Okay. You know, one of the things that he was responsible for doing, and you made reference in your comments when you talk about his relationship with Rexroth, which I want you to expand on, he was able to do through Copper Canyon the complete poems of Kenneth Rexroth, who died in 1982. Talk about, in the introduction to the complete poems, Hamill talks about how when Rexroth died, his death went unnoticed by the literary establishment.
Well, so I think it's a similar thing to Sam. Rexroth was an outsider. You really can't put him in any one group. He was a part of the Objectivists, mm-hmm. in the 1930s. He was part of that Poetry Magazine special on the Objectivists, which really launched Zhukovsky and Reznikov and Rakosi and others as a part of that. And then later, Nitecker was part of that. She saw that issue in Wisconsin, so that became her her big influence. So Rexroth was outside of things. He did teach, but he wasn't really an academic. He mm-hmm. was he was an autodidact, and he doesn't really neatly fit in anywhere. And I think Sam
don't people like immediately connect him with like the San Francisco Renaissance, like back in 1955?
Well, you know, they tried to pin him as the grandfather of the Beats, and he said, an entomologist is not a bug.
Yeah, but wasn't he the MC at the Sixth Gallery? That reading with Ginsberg. I mean, he was
there. I mean, yes, he was.
He was in the back of the room. He was in the front of the room.
he was in the front of the room, and he was responsible for a lot of the literary activity that was happening in San Francisco in the late 40s and early 50s. Yes, he was absolutely part of it. And Michael McClure tells stories about Rexroth. And Jerome Rothenberg tells stories about Rexroth, and they all do a Rexroth impression, which is fantastic. and he's huge, but yes, he does not get the kind of credit, you know, let's say as someone like Charles Olson, mm-hmm. who they continue to write about. I mean, Rexroth is doing his 100 poems from the Chinese and 100 poems from the Japanese was a huge move in this country into opening it up to the beauty of Asian wisdom culture. So I think that Rexroth is going to continue to have a place in American letters, and Sam knew that. And Sam, of course, publishing that book through Copper Canyon helped solidify that. That's an incredibly beautiful book. And, you know, I believe my interview that I did at Copper Canyon, which is in my book, American Prophets, refers to Rexroth. And I said, this is a nice way of paying him back for him saving your life. And he said, mm-hmm. no, I don't look at it that way.
Well, let me before we go, I'm going to read, as we go into our break, I'm going to read three short love poems by Rexroth. I'll just read these. You asked me what I thought about before we were lovers. The answer is easy. Before I met you, I didn't have anything to think about. And here's a second one. just us in a little house, far from everybody, far from the world, only the sound of water over stone. And then I say to you, listen, hear the wind in the trees. And this third poem by Rex Wolf. Making love with you is like drinking seawater. The more I drink, the thirstier I become, until nothing can shake my thirst but to drink the entire sea. And that's poems from the collected poems of Kenneth Redfall. Paul, are your love poems similar to these?
No, I can't. That's beyond me. Okay. At this time, I don't know. Maybe later.
Maybe later. Okay. Well, maybe later. We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to ask you some questions about two other writers. Okay.
Sure.
Okay, the show is On the Margin. My guest today is Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson is the founder of the Seattle Poetics Lab and the Cascadia Poetry Festival. He's the author of American Prophets, Interviews with Thinkers, Activists, Poets, and Visionaries. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show is On the Margin. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Mina, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Thursday, July 25th, hear from activists who have been pushing for equality and visibility of the LGBTQ+ community in D.C. since the Stonewall Uprising in New York City 50 years ago, 7 p.m. at Cleveland Park Library, 3310 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest, D.C. To reserve a space and for more information, go to washingtoniana.eventbrite.com or send email to wash.dcpl@dc.gov. Also, Thursday, July 25th, D.C.'s Historic Preservation Review Board will review the Berry Farm Tenants and Allies Association's Historic Landmark nomination for Berry Farm Dwellings, an Anacostia public housing project built in the 1940s. Please come show your support for this historic landmark at 441 4th Street Northwest, room 220 South. For the time of the hearing and more information, contact Empower DC at 202-234-9119, extension 101, or email daniel@empowerdc.org. Saturday, July 27th, the DC Metro Coalition, in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution, is having a protest and rally 12 noon in front of the White House to protest the travel restrictions to Cuba and the blockades against Cuba and Venezuela. For more information, call 202-503-9465 or email DC Metro Coalition for Cuba at gmail.com. Monday, August 5th, IPS, FICA DC, BYP 100, Sanctuary DMV, and La Colectiva will host the DC premiere of Eva Lewis's film Undeterred about a rural border town of Aravaca, Arizona, resisting the repression of U.S. Customs and Border Protection and ICE, 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Emergence Community Arts Collective, 733 Euclid Street, Northwest, D.C. For more information, visit online ips-dc.org/events or call 202-787-5242. For an online listing of these events, or if you'd like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the webpage ips-dc.org/social justice calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
David Polian, an 11-year-old boy, was fatally wounded Sunday night by a bullet fired into his home. He was taken to the hospital, pronounced dead, victim of a drive-by shooting. The gangsters didn't even know they'd killed him, shooting away, stupid, jobless, ignorant, hopeless, shooting for kicks. This 11-year-old black boy same age as my youngest. He was identified by a relative. His cousin said, we were in the living room dancing. He was standing, watching. We heard the shot. He ran to the kitchen and collapsed and began crawling. The 11-year-old black boy, same age, same race, my son, was shot and killed Sunday night when a bullet was fired into his home. He ran into the kitchen. He ran into the kitchen and collapsed. The bullet traveled 100 yards before smashing into the living room. It passed through a window near the family's recently decorated Christmas tree. He ran into the kitchen and collapsed. An 11-year-old boy was fatally wounded Sunday night. A child the same age as my son, the same age as my son. Do you know what it feels like to wait for your son to come home alive every night? And he can be 38. He can be 18. And mama, you still sitting there waiting? Because most of the men in your family are dead in jail anyway. And you're waiting. And you're waiting. An 11-year-old boy was fatally wounded Sunday night. A child the same age as my son. And I'm crying. I'm crying as though I am his mother.
Poetry of Wanda Coleman. I'm talking to Paul Nelson this morning. Paul Nelson, you include an interview with Wanda Coleman in your book, American Prophets. Talk about your relationship with her.
I met Wanda at Bumbershoot, which is an annual it's an annual arts event at Seattle Center, where the 1962 World's Fair happened and the Space Needle is. And it used to have a very large literary component. And I was MC one year, very hard work, 4 days of being on stage interviewing every act. And Wanda was one of the featured poets. I hadn't known of her work until then. And she was scheduled to go on before a very popular slam poet. And there were a lot of people in this room, the Alki room at Seattle Center in the Northwest rooms. And she knew that these people were not there to see her, but were there to see a younger poet who I think she felt hadn't paid their dues like she had and ought to be opening for her rather than the other way around. So she was motivated to give an incredibly fierce performance. I mean, you heard the emotion in that piece.
Mm-hmm.
Take that along with anger and justified rage, and then put that in there. And she left the stage. It reminds me of Hendrix opening up for the Monkees. You know, like, wait a second, what just happened? Why did we let this guy open for us? And I don't want to suggest that the slam poet was, the literary equivalent of the Monkees. Surely not. That's not the case. But he, I think, felt some humility in that situation, that he felt, because of, the nature of popularity, maybe wasn't right. And I think maybe because he was a raised right man, he realized that he should be opening up for Wanda. And so he ended up stumbling over his lines, which I'm sure he had delivered by heart many times.
Mm-hmm.
And I give that person credit because, he had the humility to realize maybe this isn't the way to be, and was thrown off his game a little bit. And that's just an example of one example of Wanda's ferocity right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we brought her to Auburn, Washington, when I was living there and active there with a literary center called SPLAB, and just incredible, very, very direct.
You know, when you say that, though, but I always look at her life as one where definitely a writer who was definitely not given the credit while she was living.
She was given credit?
I mean, wasn't given the credit that she should have been.
There's no way that she was given anything close to the credit that she deserved. And in fact, Terrence Hayes saw this interview online with Wanda, and he started writing American Sonnets because of it, and gives me credit in his book for having interviewed Wanda, and that having been the inspiration for his deciding to write what she called American Sonnets, and which sometimes had 15 lines and were incredibly ferocious in a very small amount of time.
I'm still trying to figure out the one that she dedicated to me. I read it a couple of times, and I'm still trying to work through it. But that's
sometimes that happens.
Yeah, sometimes that happens. You know, in what happens in the interview, Paul, that you have with Wanda Coleman in your book, American Prophets, is that you guys get into a conversation and dialogue around the jazz poem. Could you talk about the jazz poem?
Well, yeah. I mean, anyone who's listened to enough jazz, you can hear whether they got the jazz chops or not. I mean, and actually, it takes more than that, because there are people who know jazz who really can't get that writing into their work like Wanda did. And she talked about that. She read a bunch of my sonnets, which I never published, and she could hear that I had that in there, you know? And I think it's a very rare skill, because you have to get... be a person who's inside jazz, so
mm-hmm.
has listened to hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of jazz. But you also have to have that ability to improvise, to be able to go, to trust your first instinct. And, you know, if there's the slightest bit of anal retentiveness, it ain't going to happen.
Well, let me ask you this question here, because I think in terms of this jazz poem, we're talking about a number of things. If I brought in the poet David Lehman, okay, David Lehman, in many of his poems, has a lot of jazz references. And so I know that sometimes people say, okay, I'm going to read a jazz poem because the poem is about, like, John Coltrane or Thelonious Monk. But that's because a poem is dedicated or makes a reference to jazz. It's not necessarily a jazz poem. Am I right or wrong?
You're absolutely right. There's a poet, kind of a mainstream poet, who wrote a poem about Monk that I'm sure Monk would not be interested in. Wanda told me this, which came up as you were explaining that. She said, there are poems that honor jazz, and there are poems that emulate jazz. And she said, and yours do both. She's talking about my jazz poems. So I think that's a very important distinction. And she understood it very well. I mean, she was a jazz singer, for crying out loud. So she knew jazz. She knew how to improvise. You know, you either know how to improvise or you don't. It's like, you know, the first time I was cooking rice with my current partner, I've been with for 5 years, I didn't measure it. You know, and she's like, wait a minute.
What were you doing in the kitchen in the first place, Paul?
Hey, man, I'm a good cook, and I can do rice without even measuring it, because I've done it so many times. I have a system, right?
Mm-hmm.
She says, no, you can't do that. And it comes out perfect every time. And that's the skill of the improviser at work in the kitchen.
Well, let's talk about something that we see, okay? We see many writers going to workshops or coming, having MFA. So all of a sudden, you know, you go to a workshop and someone says, okay, I'm going to teach you, Paul, how to write the jazz poem. which to me, I always have wondered whether that's problematic, because, you know, in the case of, like, we're going to write a blues poem, well, someone will say, if you haven't had the pain and the hurt, nothing that you put on the paper is going to be a blues poem.
And
I'm wondering about that, the same thing in terms of, you know, jazz, where, you know, we create poems that are technically, you know, capturing the movement, the jazz movement, but there's no feeling there.
Well, and, you know, that's the crap that gets published, too. You know, they're going to think, oh, so-and-so's in a favor. Like, if Mary Oliver wrote a jazz poem, it's like, oh, my God, this is the best jazz poem ever. And it's like, no, it's Mary Oliver poem, you know.
Jazzed up.
Well, whatever. I mean, Wanda lived a jazz life. She knew how to improvise, and she just couldn't get over the kind of things that happened in her life that would have crushed other people. And in a sense, it did crush her on the inside somewhat. And, you know, she was very, she was very grief-stricken her whole life, but you can hear it in that I mean, that's what she did with a lot of it. She turned it into the poems that you played, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, tears your heart out when you hear it, especially when you hear her reading it.
Right. You know, I always felt that, you know, I remember that I had a sensory reading and brought Wanda from California to read up at Howard University. And I always recall that because the reading was poorly attended. I think there was two white kids who came out from University of Maryland who thought that she was like the diva. But what I immediately heard was that she had a different sound. You know, just a sound. She just had a different sound. You know, like if you go back to like, you know, Baraka's essay, you know, about how we sound, Wanda Cohen was just different.
No, original. No, mm-hmm. no question about it. And the background, the interest in jazz, the influence in jazz. She also read voraciously. Mm-hmm. She's also very, very, very bright. She was also very, very street.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many people can add up all those things?
Right.
That's a very rare combination.
Well,
you know?
That leads us into the next person I want you to talk about, who sometimes I feel is a, quote, a difficult writer. That's Nathaniel Mackey.
Yeah.
And I asked you this before, you interviewed him, and I was wondering, one, what does one need to prepare, how do one need to prepare to read Nathaniel Mackey's work in a way that one gets the full appreciation?
Well, it's really interesting, because I first knew of Nate through, there was a book called Moment's Notice, I think it's called.
Right, right.
Jazz and Poetry and Prose, mm-hmm. so it's going back to jazz again. And Art Lang and Nate Mackey were the two editors of that. And then I interviewed him on the occasion of Splay Anthem, which won the National Book Award, and is absolutely brilliant serial poem. And I have to say that Mackey is one of the world's greatest living poets mm-hmm. now, period. I mean, just he is a world poet. He's doing so many things right. He's such a smart and humble man.
And getting more attention now.
He's getting more attention. But when I read Splay Anthem, I struggled with it. It's mm-hmm. like, how do I get this? And I interviewed him, and we got along fine, and he was very gracious. Then the next book of his that I read, it was so much easier to read.
Is that Knott House or that you?
I think it was Knott House.
Knott House,
I forget the exact sequence of them, because mm-hmm. they come out as chapbooks and then as longer books through New Directions. But I think poets like him or Charles Olson or Brenda Hillman, any of these poets who's quote-unquote a little bit more difficult, it requires a little more work in advance. There's a higher bar that they're using. It's a greater degree of difficulty.
So talk about the serial poem, because that's what he's doing in his work.
And is the most open form, and he talks about that in the interview we did. Mm-hmm. He talks about how it's the most open approach to literature that he's found, and I agree with him. And he's got a serial poem that's been going on for 30 years that has two threads. One is Mu, M-U, mm-hmm. which can be seen as being influenced by Muthos, which was the original word of that connoted myth, but that was connected to the mouth. So that goes to the ancient Greek. It also connotes the lost continent of Lemuria.
Right.
And you read some of his poems, and you're going, did this happen on this continent, or did it happen on the left? You don't know. And I asked him that, and he said, only the shadow knows. You know, it's pretty difficult about that. And then the other part of it is Song of the Ondumbulu, which is a Dogon funeral rite.
Mm-hmm.
And so these Ondumbulu are these rough draft human beings who are striving to become fully human beings, and he said, essentially us.
Mm-hmm.
So the foundation of both of these threads is mysterious, it's esoteric, it's deep as hell, and he runs with it with a jazz sensibility and an outside mm-hmm. jazz sensibility. So it's interesting how, you know, you talk about outside, which is applied to jazz artists like Ornette Coleman and some of the Coltrane of the 60s, and outside poetry.
Well, isn't there like a connection you can make between Mackey and Don Cherry?
Absolutely. In fact, I think Moo was part of the influence of that, because Cherry had a record called Moo.
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely. And he was very much influenced by that and by world music of all different places in the world. Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at Nathaniel Mackey, and I guess I was looking at him, you know, not as a, you know, what you were just describing his importance as a poet, but I was always looking at the groundbreaking work that he was doing as the editor of Hambone magazine.
Yeah, and I love the way he does Hambone. He basically, because I was included in Hambone 20, you know, he meets different poets along his travels and says, you know, it's time for Hambone, and asks some people for work and selects it and puts it in. He doesn't put out a call. He doesn't wade through acres of crap, you know. he calls on his network, which is extensive and which is outside and mm-hmm. which is alive and vibrant, and he puts out another Hambone. And it's, and you pay attention, again, because you talk about a reliable narrator or reliable curator, and he certainly is.
See, I thought that someone could take, you know, I think I wrote to him about this, just to find this exactly how many Hambones there were, because that to me is like a nice anthology if you put them all together.
Absolutely, and a nice encapsulation of the outside tradition in North American poetry, right as we're living.
So see, now on the air, Paul, you just went for the bait. I figured, okay, this would be an excellent publication for the Seattle Poets Lab, don't you think?
Well, that's Mackey's. I'm lined up for about the next 10 years on stuff that we're doing. You know, the interviews that we put out with American Prophets mm-hmm. go back to 1994
right.
and Allen Ginsberg, and 1995, McClure, and they didn't come out until 2018. So I'm a little behind on the interviews myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we move towards the end of our show, you know, we were talking about the poets, and I went directly to that. But, you know, you have technicians of the sacred in here, you know. Talk about Beaver Chief.
Beaver Chief came from a line of Indian Shaker doctors. They called themselves Indian doctors. And the kind of doctoring they were doing was of the soul mm-hmm. through song and ritual and that kind of thing. And he's of the Lummi tribe, but, you know, those tribes were kind of assembled. And although there was a definite Lummi tribe, he's part of that general coastal Salish tradition. And he did these Red Cedar circles at the old Splab in Auburn, where we would sit around in a circle and talk about what's going on in our lives and learn these Salish songs that he would sing.
Well, you know, Paul, you know, we're not in a circle, but Mike's here. Mike's part of our circle, and he's going to play. You got it? Okay. Paul, I think that's a grandmother's song there.
Yeah, you know, you hear those songs and you're just taken back to them. Those songs are medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
They come to people in a state of complete submission to the divine life force, and you can hear that. You can hear the difference between art that is rhetoric or that's done to persuade or that comes from ego, and art that's really culture that comes from the deepest place within. And that's one of the things I loved about Beaver Chief and what attracts me to indigenous culture, especially here in the Northwest, mm-hmm. because Beaver Chief said that this is the last stronghold of Indian doctoring on the continent, because you couldn't push the Indians any further. They'd be in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the other individuals. You have three other individuals in your section, Technicians of the Sacred, that you include along with Beaver Chief.
Bhagavan Das went to India, inspired by Ram Das, and his book was It's Here Now, Are You?, which is a play of Be Here Now, and he had a similar experience. He became a sadhu. He was determined to be enlightened, and he sang on my program. Those songs are online on the American Prophets page, and they're also incredibly beautiful and memorable, and they stay with you forever mm-hmm. as soon as you hear them again. And he was a delightful man to be able to interview and to talk very directly about sex and lust, for instance, which I found very useful.
I like how you say that.
Well, I think that we're trained in this culture to use sex in an unskillful
right.
way.
Right.
And he was explaining that, like, it, you know, it could be a lust is one of those things that's a bottomless pit. You can just get further and further into it without really understanding what the sexual act is supposed to be.
And he was and in your interview, he creates the connection between that energy and creative energy.
Absolutely, without question, without question. Phyllis Curat is a person who's literally a witch and also a lawyer, a person you do not want to miss.
I skipped over that. I skipped over that entry. Okay. Okay.
You might want her on your side. Of
right. Man. Okay.
She represented the UN. She represented paganism at the UN level and was on a panel with the Dalai Lama. Hmm. So that gives you some sense of her credibility.
Right.
And then there's E. Richard Atleo, who's an hereditary chief of the New Jutnal tribe, which we used to know as Nootka, and is up there in Clackwat Sound, British Columbia. So he's another Cascadian, yeah. And he was the first indigenous man in BC to get a PhD.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back.
He talks about, Ethelbert, he talks about the vision quest of his grandfather who hunted whales. I mean, a single man hunting a whale, and the vision quest and the scientific nature of this vision quest to get this job done. It's fascinating.
All right. You know, what I did, Paul, I guess you can see, I sort of went to the poets and then the technicians of the sacred. But your book actually opens up with thinkers and activists. And as we get to the end of our show, I want you to talk about one person whose work is represented, who you interviewed. And that's Rupert Sheldrake, who has the book Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. Talk about that entry.
Well, Sheldrake has this notion of morphogenetic fields, and that is that dogs don't know you're coming home because they can smell you or because you're coming home at the same time or anything like that, which he proves through scientific inquiry. He doesn't necessarily prove that it's morphogenetic fields, but he dares people to come up with a better theory as to why that happens. The dog and the human, especially when they're close, are connected by a social field. He also explored that notion in mothers and daughters and the connection between them. And it also explains, in his view, why place has memory. You can go into a place and, you know, the walls have ears. You can just feel. It's like going into a cathedral, like in Mexico or in Europe. You can feel the power of all the prayer, of all the sacredness, all the sacred acts that have happened there. He believes that quality is morphic fields, morphogenetic fields. And he is derided as a pseudo-scientist, but he's actually a real scientist. And he shows that much of science is very dogmatic. And his TED talk about pseudoscience was banned by TED.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. And so you can still find that on YouTube where he talks about pseudoscience. He's challenging their dogma. He's well worth checking out. In the interview and on the link at AmericanProfits.com, you can actually hear, you can hear any of these interviews because all the audio is on there, not all the audio of everything.
I hear you with a pun there. You know, he's challenging their dogma, right?
There's a bumper sticker out here I saw many years ago that said, "My karma ran over my dogma."
Do you have a dog, Paul?
No, not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay.
We've got two rabbits. But they're my honeys.
And do the rabbits know when you're coming home?
Yes, because they know it's time to get a blueberry or a.
Do they know when you try to pull them out of the hat, Paul?
I pulled rabbits out of many places in my time.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you woke up this morning. I know you're out there on the West Coast. But, you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that your family's doing well. So thank you very much for being on The Margin, Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson has been my guest this morning. He is the founder of the Seattle Poetics Lab and the Cascadia Poetry Festival. He's the author of American Prophets, interviews with thinkers, activists, poets, and visionaries. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW, 89.3 FM.